expensive, requires real thought.
Yeah.
Buying things can be a distraction. So you have to know what you're doing. Now, we made more runs at things.
Yeah.
We took a run at SAP. That was documented years ago.
Business software company in Europe.
Exactly. Right. And because of our issues with the European Competition Commission, we backed away. But we spent a lot of time on that. We certainly made a big run at Yahoo.
Yeah.
We couldn't agree
on
price.
That was you after Bill left.
Absolutely. Yeah. Was it after you left?
I think it was right
around
the
time.
He was the CEO at that time.
Bill was still hanging around.
He hadn't totally devoted himself to
that. He was still at Microsoft. Yeah.
So you made a $35 billion offer, as I remember.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Yeah.
We made a $33 share offer, about $35 billion. Exactly right. They wanted, I don't know what they really wanted. They said they wanted 40, and I don't know if they would have taken 36, 37. I don't know.
You don't know, because you reached your limit of what you thought you were willing to pay. And
I was willing to go 33.xx, and I told that to the guys. You can get me to do something beyond the decimal point, but I'm not going past 33 point something something. Because on my model, everything, that you got to be disciplined. When you're looking to spend a lot of money, you have to be.
Is this unfair to Microsoft? You guys were ahead of the game on many things. Tablets, even search, even speech technology, a whole range of things. You were there. You weren't dumb.
Absolutely.
You had the best computer scientists because you were the big, successful. Mm-hmm. You were the...
Still are.
Still are. But you didn't...
Charlie, we didn't make the hardware. It's hard for people to understand just how profound that is. You have to have a way to go to market.
Right.
You have to have a way to make money. Right. You have to have a way to get a feedback loop with the customers by being direct.
Right.
Speech technology, what is it? It's a fundamental part of a phone.
Right.
Of course. Touch technology, pen technology. Right. These are fundamental parts of hardware. And we were going through many layers of indirection.
Right.
And the software had to flourish through the lens. Where did we get vision technology right? With our Kinect hardware, which is part of Xbox.
The lesson here is you better have a connection to your customers so you get the kind of feedback so that you can see where the reality of the world is and what's at the cutting edge.
I recently went through this. So I was doing a deposition for a case that Microsoft's still involved in, but it was about something mobile. I don't want to go through the details. But I had to go back then in the deposition. The lawyers are showing me all these memos about Microsoft and mobile technology back 25 years.
Right.
And you read through them and you say, boy, we really knew it was important. And we never found a way to really get into the loop. There was one thing we missed technologically. All of our brilliant people, Bill Gates, we missed one thing. We loved pens. It turns out the world right now will say the finger is even more important than the pen as an input device.
Yeah.
Pen will be important, but the finger was more important.
Right.
And Apple got that right. That's a very powerful notion. Low-cost processors and the finger. You know, a lot of money's been made on that with smartphones.
If I ask this question, why did Steve Jobs get it? You know, and Gates and Ballmer didn't get it.
Might be many reasons. Might be many reasons. Yeah. A better than B, blah, blah, blah. Who knows? Can't remark about all of them, but I'll give you a fundamental one. Apple was born as an integrated hardware and software company. They were going to try this differently than we were. Now, they got it right their first pass.
Right.
Give them credit. That was a fundamental characteristic of the way Steve liked to do things, Steve Jobs. But our fundamental characteristic is get in the market, get the feedback, and improve. There used to be a thing people would say about Microsoft, sometimes we don't get things right until the third version.
Exactly.
Okay?
Right.
But on this, we had no hardware and software muscle until Surface, really, until we said we're just going into it with Surface and the phones. Now, our company actually has a hardware and a software muscle. And if it takes integrated innovation across that boundary, Apple was going to get there. They were born that way. We were born on the software side
indirectly. On your way now is what you seem to be saying.
Look, I own the stock, Charlie. I believe. Cut me open and it says Microsoft all the way
through. Well, okay, but you don't want blind faith here. You want to have
I don't have blind faith because you
got more at stake than anybody.
Yes. Then there's two fundamental capabilities which are new. My Stanford Business School class.
Yes.
One of our seven major topics was just called capabilities. How do companies build new muscle? I call it getting in the weight room.
Yeah.
Microsoft, we had to build muscle, not just in software, which is where we started. We've now had to build muscle in the cloud. And we're one of only three or four or five companies in the world who have cloud muscle. Yeah. We've had to build muscle in hardware. We're now one of only three or four or five companies that really have any muscle, if you will, in consumer hardware. I mean, after Apple and Samsung, who else is really trying to do these things? And maybe Facebook would, maybe Google will, we'll see. But you got to have capability. If you don't have capability, you can't execute. We have the right capabilities. We've got genius people. We have incredible cash flow that gives us permission to do things, to get into new areas. The company needs to move forward, not just to buy things. The company needs to build things. And I think in the last 6 years, I would call the last 6 years the best, probably six of my best years contributing to Microsoft.
You did more value-added stuff to Microsoft in your last 6 years than you did in the 14 years, in the first 8 years, or even your previous life. Before you were
if you go back to the best work probably I did was between 80 and 86, okay, all right, something like that.
Okay.
Take out 80 and 86, and then the next best 6 years would have been the last. What did we do? We developed a hardware capability. We developed a cloud capability in the enterprise. We developed a machine learning capability through our work on Bing. We grew our profits. We did all of that. Now, we didn't do phones. But 08 is kind of about the, when does iPhone start? 07, I think. So we were behind the eight ball. But I do some of the work I actually think was my best work at Microsoft probably were those first 6 years and those last 6 years.
So, but what would be the thing you did in the last 6 years was finally getting into phone and finally?
We got into cloud.
Cloud, okay.
You go back to 08. We didn't have cloud capability. We didn't have machine learning capability. We didn't have
what Jeff Bezos did. I mean, he started out with a e-commerce, and look what he has now.
What does he have now? I don't know what to say about Amazon. I like Amazon. Nice company.
Well, they're in the cloud.
They make no money, Charlie. In my world, you're not a real business until you make some money. I have a hard time with businesses that don't make money at some point.
Yeah.
I get it if you don't make money for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
But Amazon's 21 years old and not making money?
Yeah, but in building up, they obviously have enough stockholders that think highly of what they're doing.
And bravo to them. But I don't know when they'll make money. And if I was a share owner, it's an expensive company.
Yeah.
I mean, market cap's $150 billion almost.
Yeah.
Eventually, if you're worth $150 billion, eventually somebody thinks you're going to make $15 billion pre-tax.
Yes, they do.
And they make about zero. And there's a big gap between zero and 15.
Yeah. But is it simple that they don't simply go by, reporting earnings, that they'd say plow back?
Look, it's working for them.
And look at the enterprise system they've developed, too. I mean, this was not their core competence.
They have built capability. I will give you that. I think one capability every business is expected to have is the capability to make money. That requires a certain kind of discipline, a certain kind of mindset. And ultimately, if you don't have the capability, and it's not something...
And you're not sure it's there.
I don't know. Look, there are neighbors. I like the people. They're fine. But as a businessman, if you ask me what I'm proud of, I'm proud of the fact that I made $250 billion under my watch as CEO. And I know in our industry, only product matters to people. And product is everything in the long run. But product that makes money is important.
But what about this, some argue? When you took over as CEO, the market cap was what?
500-something. I don't know, 600 maybe.
And when you left as CEO, what was it?
200-something.
$300 billion in market cap?
Gone.
I mean, come on.
Come on. That's a silly way to measure a CEO.
Is it really?
Very silly.
Why is that silly?
The market was in a froth. I took over at a time. Take any company that was considered cool at the time.
Yeah.
GE, Microsoft. It didn't matter who.
The market was silly. Right.
The market was silly. And if you use the market as your measure of success, you will do silly things. The truth is, our profit tripled in that same period of time. Our profit went from about $8 billion or $9 billion to $28 billion.
But why didn't the market but why don't you think the market appreciated that?
It was, too high to start.
Right.
And it got too low.
I mean, the P.E. was too high.
The P.E. was too high. Way too high.
Right.
The P.E. got low because people didn't know whether I was making good investments or investments that they would think were folly when I left. About the time I left, two things happened. We had one activist investor who said, you know, they got a pretty good business nobody focuses on, which is actually the one that makes a lot of our money, called our enterprise business, right, which I feel like I started and did a pretty good job with, because it makes 70-80% of the money. 70% probably. And then at the same time, Satya takes over as CEO, and people want to give the company a fresh look. Which is a great thing. It's a great thing. It's one of the advantages of newness. And I actually do think that at some point in time, for any organization, being fresh and having people give a fresh look and think about things, and a new CEO is a great
theory,
chance
to do. That's
the
theory of management, in fact. I mean, people like
I actually think it's right.
People like Bart Giamatti and others say, look, if in terms of the management class, you know, you come in and you have about 10 years, then you should, you know, bring somebody else in.
And I don't really know whether you got 5 or 10. I had 34.
But at some, you had.
I had 34, and it was great for me, Charlie.
Yeah, it sure as the hell was.
And actually, if for anybody who assesses businesses by the numbers, it was great for the people who own our stock.
Would you rather have today Microsoft's hand, Google's hand, Apple's hand, Amazon's hand?
Definitely not Amazon's. No question. Okay, I mean, it's a great company, but if you...
No, I understand what you're saying.
I mean, it sort of defines, by defining the problem set. If you're, again, depends on what your time frame is. If your time frame's 1 year, I'd probably take Apple, because they got the most earnings. If your time frame is 30 years, then I'd probably take Microsoft and Google. And I'd pick Microsoft over Google because I'm completely non-objective.
What did the decision about Nokia have to do with you leaving Microsoft?
Well, I mean, I had looked at buying phone companies for a few years. Mm-hmm. Let's just put it that way.
You understood you needed hardware.
Yeah, and I started Surface. I'd agree. I basically thought we needed to do
Surface. It's a tablet.
It's a PC that's a tablet, or a tablet that's a PC. Right. I was doing our Microsoft Surface product. I initiated that, you know, with some discomfort, I would say, from our people. We kept it very quiet. Even the leadership, who I forced to start it, didn't love it. The board wasn't sure about it, but went along. I was sure we needed to go this direction about probably 2009, 2010 is when we kicked all this off. But we needed to go farther and faster, particularly in phones. And so the first half of 2013, with the board's knowledge, I was having discussions with Nokia about possible acquisition. They were already our partner. If you looked at the time, 88, 89% of all the Windows phones were being produced by Nokia anyway. So the real question is, where would that partnership go? And I thought the best thing to do for the partnership to strengthen our position would be to just put the companies all the way together as opposed to having this kind of a partnership. I rocked the board through my thinking. They said, go ahead, talk to them. We had a board set of discussions. We came to a meeting that wound up being a little tumultuous. Details are probably not that important, but the board meeting wound up being tumultuous because there were some weird dynamics, let me just say, around it. It wasn't just about the merit of the argument. We didn't get to the merit because we got sort
of...
What
were the other dynamics?
It's not worth
it. But is it you and Bill?
Really not worth going through. So we had a kind of a tumultuous argument about essentially the center point of the future. We are going to be software guys for our lives, but unless we innovate across that boundary, that was important to me. I had spent 4 or 5 years coming to the point of view that my number one mistake was I didn't get there sooner, Charlie. Yeah. And I basically said, this is really important. And while the board wound up ultimately agreeing with that...
They bought Nokia.
They bought Nokia because they knew. It. By that time, I told them, look, by that time they heard from me, I will probably go whether you buy it or not.
You already said that.
Mm-hmm.
Why'd you say that?
Because I thought if they buy it, we've had enough negative tension between us that it would be better off giving it to a new owner, to a new leader, if the board wanted to buy it, and if the board didn't want to buy it, peace. It was important to my strategy. At some point, if you don't have support for your strategy, you should go. Well, the board decided they liked that piece and bought the business, but they bought it knowing that I would probably say this is a good time to hand off the leadership, not just of Nokia, but of the whole company to another leader.
But it sounds like everybody agreed and signed on to that idea, that if, in fact, you know, you had decided that either for the reason you just outlined, I'm leaving.
Yeah, at that stage. I mean, if we hadn't had our tumultuous discussion, who knows? Who knows? But we did. And then I said, look, there's an advantage in this next generation of Microsoft. Satya Nadella, my replacement, calls it cloud first, mobile first. I think you can also call it what I used to say, devices and services, because those are our new capabilities. Right. In this new world, let the new leader build this from the get-go. Satya had helped be one of the absolute leaders below me in building out our cloud footprint in every sense, because he had worked on Bing and our other cloud properties. And now it's his generation.
He's the guy you would have recommended.
He's a very. We had a couple guys internally who I loved, Satya and at least one other guy who I loved internally. We had some good external candidates, but, you know, boards go through weird dynamics. But when we got to the final decision, Satya was the only internal candidate left and my favorite candidate at that stage.
Everybody wants to know, you know this, how much of this had to do when you became CEO of this, what the relationship was between you and Bill? Everybody wants to know that.
Yeah, it's a complicated thing, which
is impossible. Give us an insight to it.
I think everybody, look, 14 years ago, 15, almost 15 years ago, I took over CEO. Bill had asked me to become CEO. I said, do you really want me to become CEO? Because I'm perfectly happy. He had me president at the time. I was perfectly happy being president. And he said, yeah, I really want you to be CEO. I said, do you really want me to be CEO? Or is this like a fig leaf so you don't have to take some burden? No, I really want you to be CEO. And we spent a year arguing. Because I knew how to be his deputy, and he knew how to be my boss. But he had said, no, he'd like to switch that. And, of course, I didn't know how to be his boss, and he didn't know how to be my deputy. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we ever really figured it out. We got through what I would call a very tumultuous year in 2001, and we sort of settled things down. But the mojo was never quite the same. And if you look at it, I would tell you probably the least productive years for me at Microsoft were those first few years as CEO. Bill and I were out of rhythm. So the product direction was a little out of rhythm. That was when we did our Longhorn and Vista releases of Windows, which were not... I mean, our least successful work was in that period. Yeah. When Bill and I were working together in the early 2000s was when I would say both of us did perhaps our least good work. We understood the old model.
Because you couldn't get right boss, you know, and all that.
Whatever. I mean, it was a combination probably of a lot of factors. We never got it right. And then 2006, 6 years later... Bill announced that he'd be leaving.
Right. So then it was all up to you, although he was chairman of the board.
We had a two-year period where he transitioned.
But was this part of a different... Did you see things differently? I mean, we now know how you felt strongly about the idea of connection to the consumer. We know how you felt strongly about devices, about having a phone, all that. Did Bill see things differently? Did you live together and have two separate philosophies, two separate worldviews?
Yeah, I think that would be oversimplifying also. It depends on the year. It depends on when you're talking about. Look, our partnership, I think most people would say, was amongst the most successful in business history.
Absolutely. Well, as you would say, look at the profit stream.
Look at the business, look at the profit stream, look at the growth. But it wasn't, you know, at the same high level of performance for every year that Bill was full-time, which was my first 28 years at Microsoft. We had better times and we had worse times.
No, but could you view it as a complementary relationship? In other words, his strengths were complemented your weaknesses, whatever they be, relatively, and your strength complemented his
Working at its best, that's the way it worked. It didn't work as well after we sort of flipped things around, I would say, because that's when we did Vista Longhorn. right? Longhorn Vista.
Right, right.
Some of the
operating
worst
systems.
Some of the worst Windows work we did was, you know, kind of Bill as technical leader, me as CEO. That was the early 2000s. That was not our best work. And I think I've done some of my best work, actually, in the last 6 years after Bill left. And then, of course, the 20 years before that, it's hard to argue. We did some of our best work, and we did a great job together, certainly from 80 to 2000. Well, we had a tough year in 80 to 81, too.
What was that?
Well,
oh, that was it. Was that the
Hiring people, bankrupt the company?
Right, right.
We had a couple tough adjustments, okay, but we figured it out.
My next to last question: Did the antitrust suit throw you guys off your game?
It certainly wasn't helpful. I think it was far more impacting on Bill than me. Mm. I mean, the whole company, of course, got some level of distraction by it.
It was,
were you going to be broken up?
Disruptive and all that.
New rules, the European Commission, and it's a distract. It was a significant distraction, certainly to the company. No question about that. I think emotionally, it impacted Bill more than me. And I probably would write it down as one reason why he wanted to flip things around and have me take over as CEO.
That's,
I mean, the timing, if you look at the timing, it's not surprising. It was plus or minus about the time I think the judge ordered us to be broken up.
That's why I brought it up. How old are you?
58.
You're 58 years old. This is great. You're 58 years old. You're the largest stockholder of a huge and profitable company, which gives you, you know, opportunity to do 1,000 different things. You've just achieved a goal that you have thought about for a long time and made efforts. All of a sudden, you didn't just get a basketball team.
I got a great basketball team.
In a place that you love.
Absolutely. No, I'm fired up.
What's there not to love about being Steve Ballmer?
Oh, I'm very happy.
Yeah.
I mean, partly I'm even happy with the fact that not everything, you know, I love being at Microsoft and everything. Not everything was known about how we were going to do X, Y, or Z, but I kind of knew what I was doing every day.
Yeah.
I have total free will. I get to decide completely how to spend my time. I get to find whatever it's going to be that's really going to get me charged up, whether it's civic or not.
Oh, man.
That free will, that to me, it's scary, but it excites me.
Yeah, and I think all of us, I mean, some are able to do it, others are not. I mean, it's something we owe ourselves, regardless of people who are not at your income level and your asset level, just a chance to be able to look back. I mean, we have one time at life, one time, you know, and too many of us get caught up on some kinds of treadmills and don't sort of step off for a moment and say, you know, I mean, I have this image of you lying in bed with your Surface. I mean, clearly it wasn't an iPad.
It was a Surface, yeah, by Microsoft.
I'll bet you have an iPad somewhere, iPhone somewhere.
I do not.
You have no iPhone in your...
I do not. I do not. My children do not. My wife does not.
And the Clippers will not?
The Clippers individually are allowed to do whatever they want to do.
But the team,
they have free will.
But the
anything
team.
The team buys? Come on, Charlie. We're going to buy Microsoft with my money.
And there is... There is this, finally. There is an image of you in bed or lying on top of the bed. This,
I know what you're going to say. I think I know.
Here he is, all 6'5" of him, laying on the bed with his Surface on his chest, watching because he fell in love with a CBS show.
A, I'm 5'11". B, I do love the shit. 5'11" and A. I used to be over 6 feet. I'm shrunk. But, yeah, I love that show.
Yeah.
And it was funny because
The Good Wife. Right.
About Christmas time, I was kind of out of day-to-day management.
Yeah.
I mean, it was time to start the transition, but we weren't quite ready.
You didn't have any meetings you needed to go to.
Well, I didn't want to start anything new for what might be a month. Except I started The Good Wife.
Yeah.
I'm 106 episodes or something in. I've watched them all, and it's a heck of a series.
And people, I mean, it was just a piece in the New Yorker magazine saying it's one great show.
It is.
You know, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Much success.
Thanks.
If I'm in L.A., I'm going to come watch the Clippers.
Email me.
You know?
You come with us.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Steve Ballmer for the hour. Thank you for joining us. See you next time.
German Group is growing.
Getting in a groove.
Growth is gratifying.
The goal is to grow.
Gotta get greater growth.
I just talked to UPS. They've got expert advice, special discounts, new technologies, like smart pickups. They'll only show up when you print a label, and it's automatic. We save time and money.
Time? Money?
Time and money.
Awesome.
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 I love logistics.
15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Everybody knows that.
Well, did you know certain cartoon characters should never have an energy drink?
Action.
Geico.
Introducing the Birds of America collection. 50 stunning hand-painted plates commemorating the state birds of our proud nation.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Quality furniture and housewares products from Thailand can be found in all corners of the globe today. They reflect well on the high levels of thought, designs, and skills that were put into creating these distinctive items. Thai houseware products are trusted worldwide and have been proven to be among the world's best in quality. Think design and quality. Think Thailand.
How do you start your day so you make better investment decisions?
You watch Bloomberg Surveillance to find out what the markets are doing. And you talk to smart people. Bloomberg Surveillance, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Television.
My name is Richard Capozzelli, and I created the Addiction Advisor to be a place where people struggling with addiction can receive help and information. A place where they can talk with people that understand addiction because they experienced it firsthand. Today, addiction is destroying millions of lives, families, and futures. It's a disease that kills and literally takes everything from the addict and those they love. Unfortunately, most people are in denial about their addiction. It doesn't just go away on its own. So if you or a loved one are suffering with an addiction, please get help. Call us. We understand what you're going through. Our compassionate advisors are available 24 hours a day to listen and to help you think through your options. Most importantly, the Addiction Advisor service is absolutely free of charge or obligation. Please, reach out for help. Don't wait another day. Call us now.
Some come here to build something smarter. Some come here to build something stronger. Others come to build something faster, something safer, something greener, something the whole world can share. People come to Boeing to do many different things, but it's always about the very thing we do best.
Partnerships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success. Together, invest in remarkable Indonesia.
I'm Mark Halperin.
And I'm John Heilman. And with all due respect to the Kansas City Royals, you can bet that Josh Earnest is as sweaty right now as Charlie Crist without his fans.
Tonight on the show, the White House learns how to drive a czar, Joni Ernst gets high on the hog, and we score some tickets to a TED Talk. But first, there's a new dramedy airing in some states with tight Senate races. It's called The Barack Obama Show, starring Barack Obama and produced by the GOP. Here's just a sample of the president's many star turns.
Mark Udall voted with President Obama 99% of the time.
99%?
I don't agree with anyone 99% of the time.
Bruce Braley and Barack Obama teamed up to give us Obamacare.
She's voted with Obama 99% of the time.
A new face to take orders from Barack Obama.
Michelle Nunn, Obama's senator, not yours.
But wait, there's more. It's not just in the ads. It's also in the debates. Last night in New Hampshire, Senator Jeanne Shaheen was asked point blank, would she tell a pollster she approved of the job President Obama is doing?
Do you approve, yes or no?
In some ways, I approve. In some things, I don't approve.
So, John, we're going to see this straight through, both in the ads and out on the trail and in the remaining debates. Democrats pressed on the question of their association with the president. Can they withstand the Obama linkage onslaught?
Not if they continue to be quite this lame about how they answer the questions. We have seen this coming a mile away for a long time, ever since Alison Lundgren Grimes refused to answer whether she voted for President Obama. It's been building, and no one is answering the question well. It is, again, not that hard a question. I support the president on the minimum wage. I support the president on equal pay for equal work. I support the president on X, Y, and Z. There are a lot of things you can say without getting trapped and looking defensive in the way that they all do. And if they keep answering this way, they're going to get slaughtered.
And you had rare convergence, the New York Times editorial board and Joe Scarborough both this morning saying exactly that, which is you've got to say what you're for. They're in such a fetal position, crouch on this
thing. Right.
And Jeanne Shaheen, I saw her last Thursday night giving a speech at the Jefferson Jackson Dinner in Manchester. She was fantastic. That and confident and full-throated, that answer, timid, and a representative, even in New Hampshire, let alone these candidates in these other in these harder red states.
They must find some guts on these questions.
My question is, the president now, we don't know his full campaign schedule, right, but it seems like he'll do a few more governor's races,
right,
and that it.
That's
going to a single Senate race, Iowa.
Well, they're talking about him going to Michigan to do the governor's race and the Senate race there, but that's really the only thing on his schedule, I believe, from the Senate races. And I think that's going to raise a question that the president's now going to have to start answering, which is, how can it be in a race where you have become the central focus? How can you be hiding under...
Not playing offense.
Not playing offense and hiding your face everywhere. All right, okay. So let's talk about Senate races. Our Senate race to watch tonight is in Iowa between Democrat Bruce Braley, or maybe it's Bailey, if you believe Michelle Obama, and noted piglet emasculator Republican Joni Ernst. Mark, Joni Ernst has a striking new ad up on the air, which we're going to come back to later. But the conventional wisdom right now is that the race is hers to lose. Does Bruce Braley have a way back? And if so, what is it?
He does. Look, people, I think, have started to assume, based on some of the public polling, this race is over. Democrats have had the stronger ground game in Iowa for a while, and they still do. Republicans concede the Democrats' registration, early vote, very strong. In this case, Republicans have narrowed the gap. They certainly have the Republicans certainly have the governor's race. Braley is going to have to start to perform stronger, particularly in the Democratic-based parts of the state, in the eastern part of the state, where he is not doing as well now as he's going to need to win.
Right.
But if their ground game turns and he can get some breaks in the closing moments, she's playing a pretty cautious game right now, Democrats point out. But she's out there as a happy warrior. I think right now I'd still give her the edge, but I don't think Democrats are done here fighting because they have a history of a strong ground game.
Well, it is, and it's Iowa, right? And Democrats have been organized there now for two successive cycles. They have that ground game. The Obama machine is still in some ways in place. But I'll make the point that you've made many times, which is the governor there, Terry Branstad, is going to win by a mile. And the idea that if Joni Ernst is starting to get a measurable lead, how it is that she would lose that race when Branstad wins by 15 or 12 points or something, I just don't figure out how that happens. So.
She's been proven to be a pretty strong candidate and resilient in the face of a lot of attacks from the Democrats. So
yeah.
She's got a good chance. All right. Republicans woke up this morning to an Associated Press poll that made them happier than John Boehner with a corkscrew.
Boom!
The poll suggests likely voters nationwide are now more inclined towards GOP control of Congress than they were just a month ago, and that more voters than before are expecting that outcome. Take a look at these numbers. This is from, again, an AP poll. Question was asked a month ago, who do you want to control Congress? In September, it was Republicans narrowly 45-42. AP asked the same question in this new poll, 47-39 Republican. People want Republicans. Now, this is likely voters nationwide. You got to assume in some of these battleground states, that number is likely even wider. Second question the AP asked was, who do you think will control the Senate after the midterms? Last month, people thought Democrats would control 52-47. Now, in a bit of fulfilling prophecy, perhaps. The numbers have switched around here. Republicans now, people think, will control the Senate after the midterms, 55 to Democrats, 45. John, does this poll give us enough evidence that there's going to be a Republican, as our Japanese friends would say, tsunami? Or is this just an outlier of some sort?
We've now seen polling that's been moving this direction pretty consistently for the last couple of weeks. I have resisted more than anybody the notion that a Republican wave has been forming, but it's the data is starting to look pretty striking. The first number is now outside the margin of error, and the change, the trend line, is all bad for Democrats. You can still imagine a path for Democrats holding on to control of the Senate, but boy, it's starting to look, the odds are dwindling in that.
Of all the national polling data we've seen of late, this poll could be an outlier. Those two questions are particularly striking. When voters start to think something's going to happen,
yes,
it's much more likely to happen because voters are pretty savvy about going in the direction. As I said, that's national. If you look at some of these key races, very negative for Democrats in that data.
Absolutely, 100%. All right. It's a happy first day on the job for Ron Klain, the recently appointed so-called Ebola czar, met with President Obama just this afternoon. Halperin, my question to you, I just referred to him as the Ebola czar, is he actually an Ebola czar, or is he a semi-czar, a pseudo-czar, a quasi-czar? What is that guy?
Ron Klain has a lot of strengths, but as we said on the program before, he's not a czar type. He's more of an inside operator. So I've never thought he was going to play a very big role in terms of the kind of public face that you think of, someone taking charge of a crisis like this. And I know you've got some reporting that suggests just that.
Yeah, I had an email last night from someone close to the White House who wanted to dispel the notion that Ron Klain is anything like an Ebola czar. And as I said, no, he's not the Ebola czar. He's the Ebola coordinator. And, you know, we've talked about how Ron is a skilled bureaucratic organizer and in player, is an inside job. But that's what this email was basically saying. Hey, you guys have got it all wrong. He was never meant to be an Ebola czar. And it raises a whole bunch of questions. Like we had said on the show that Barack Obama did not want to appoint an Ebola czar, and apparently he didn't. But they managed the optics horribly because they gave the impression that that's exactly what he is. And only now are they trying to quietly, in these background emails, try to dispel that and tamp it down. It's crazy.
I think he's there in part to take pressure off the scheduling of the National Security Advisor, the Homeland Security Advisor. Those two people were drawn into Ebola in a way. There's so much else on their plate now. I think they wanted him there to basically be a traffic cop and a coordinator.
But if they wanted that, they should have said that much more clearly at the very beginning when they appointed him.
And people now who think they're going to see daily Ron Klain briefings or twice daily Ron Klain briefings or him up on the Hill in a high-profile way, it's not going to happen. I don't think it was ever in the cards.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. All right. Every journalist we know is taking time today to remember the great Ben Bradlee, one of the finest political editors in American history and a tireless steward of the Washington Post. Earlier today, John and I spoke with one of Bradlee's disciples, the great political reporter Dan Baltz, about how Bradlee assembled his team.
His attitude, both in political coverage and in everything else, was hire the best people you can find and let them do their work. He was not a micromanager by any stretch of the imagination. He encouraged people to do what he thought they could do.
John, what made Bradlee such a popular editor with his reporters, but also such a great editor?
Well, the first thing is the thing that Dan mentions here, which is that he understood that you need talent, right? And the first thing he did was he hired David Broder when he started to build up the Washington Post coverage. And he hired people like Dan and hired a whole generation of political reporters. He built a team of stars, like a 27 Yankees kind of team. The second thing was he had an incredible nose for a story, and he was just so competitive all the time. And the third thing was he understood fun. Journalism for him was a fun business. Politics for him was a fun business. And he infused the Washington Post newsroom with a sense of adventure and courage.
Yeah, you know, I didn't know him well. I met him enough times to know he was kind of like the greats of American political journalism in our career. People like Johnny Apple of the New York Times, big personalities who understood how to have fun, but also the journalism is serious. You have to hold powerful interests accountable.
Of course.
He did that with Watergate, and he did that, of course, with the Pentagon Papers.
Yeah.
But he also did it hiring people like Dan Baltz and David Broder and Ann Devroy, the great White House reporter.
Fantastic.
People who understood that the platform of the Post came with the responsibility to hold the White House accountable, both political parties responsible. He was a great man. He will be missed.
He will be totally missed by all of us. All right. Coming up, a potential Republican presidential candidate makes us an offer we can't refuse. Ted Cruz is next.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by Koch Industries. Learn more at KochCareers.com.
Koch Industries started in the heartland, and we've expanded to nearly every state. Today, that's more than 60,000 American jobs. You may not always see our name on the products you use, but we help make better food, clothing, shelter, technologies, and other necessities. Here, We build on each other's ideas to create more opportunities for people everywhere. Together, we are Coke.
A remote that lives on your phone. More Wi-Fi in more places. A movie library you can take wherever you go. Internet speeds that have gotten faster 13 times in 12 years. At Comcast, we're creating new possibilities. Together with Time Warner Cable, we'll be able to extend those to more people. Comcast and Time Warner Cable. Together is better for more people.
Brightline, instruments for professionals.
Introducing the new and improved Bloomberg app for your iPhone and iPad. Financial markets change even when you're away from your desk. Bloomberg gives you a snapshot of what's moving, plus breaking news, video, and sophisticated portfolio management tools. Download the free Bloomberg application and stay ahead wherever you are. Also available on Android, BlackBerry, and Windows Phone.
Our guest tonight has been called the Republican Barack Obama. So I assume that means if he's elected president, he'll cut wasteful spending while simultaneously monitoring all of my iPhone activity. And although he's famous for filibustering, tonight he's promised to keep his answers short. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, thanks for coming on the program from Houston. We appreciate it.
Gentlemen, it's good to be with you.
So, Senator, we'll talk about the political news of the day and of the next few weeks, which is the midterms and the control for the Senate. Mm-hmm. Appraise the battleground for us. You're a pretty skilled political analyst. How likely do you think it is that your party takes majority control, and which of the races do you think will determine that outcome?
Well, I'm very optimistic. I think it is more likely than not that Republicans are going to retake the Senate and that we're going to retire Harry Reid as majority leader. For the last month, I've been on the road almost nonstop, have been going to battleground states, have been up in Iowa, I'm headed to Georgia, I'm going to be in Alaska, I'm traveling all across the country trying to turn out conservatives. And to take control of the Senate, we need six seats. There are right now 10, 12, as many as 14 seats that are seriously competitive that are within 1 or 2 points.
So, Senator, what's your
hunch? If they all break,
what's your hunch about which ones will be the closest or the ones that will really, on election night, be the ones that decide it?
Well, there are a total of 7 Democratic seats that are up in red states that Mitt Romney carried. 6 of them, Barack Obama got 42% or less. So the natural place to start are the 42% states. Those are West Virginia, Montana, South Dakota, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Alaska. Of those, it appears West Virginia and Montana are largely off the table. The Democrats are not seriously contesting those. South Dakota, it's a little quirky with an independent, but I think South Dakota will be a safe Republican seat. And then I think all 3 of the remaining, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Alaska, look like very strong pickup opportunities. I think the incumbents there are vulnerable. And then there are a whole bunch of additional seats that I think are terrific pickup opportunities. I think Iowa, Joni Ernst is one of the strongest Senate candidates in the country. I think her opponent, the Democrat, is not a strong candidate. I think Colorado is a great pickup opportunity. I think New Hampshire, Scott Brown is running one heck of a campaign in New Hampshire. So there are a lot of seats that are in play right now. And if they break right, Republicans could pick up 10, 11, 12 seats. If they break wrong, we could end up with 3 or 4, just enough to leave Democrats in the majority. I don't think that'll happen, but it's close enough it could break either way.
All right, Senator, you're a lawyer, and you have some very strong views on judicial philosophy and judicial policy. In recent days, there have been a number of rulings from the court, one of them on the Wisconsin voter ID law, one on the Texas abortion clinic ruling, and one on gay marriage, obviously, recently, where it seems as though Chief Justice Roberts has not been as vocally siding with other conservative justices on the court. And so you're starting to hear some people on the right wondering whether the Chief Justice is, in fact, a real, true conservative. Do you worry yourself that Chief Justice Roberts is going soft?
Well, I think it's premature to come to those conclusions. Obviously, the Chief Justice's vote in the Obamacare decisions was a shock to just about every court watcher. It was astonishing. It was very disappointing. I think it severely has tarnished the Chief Justice's legacy that he did not vote to strike down that law, that he didn't. That he was willing to rewrite the statute to try to save it. I think that was a mistake. But more broadly, I think at this point, Chief Justice Roberts' tenure, still setting aside Obamacare, has been characterized by a consistency and a dedication upholding the law. And I'm certainly hopeful that the Chief Justice will continue doing so.
A lot of people think the Chief Justice was on the liberal side on the gay marriage decision. Do you suspect that he was on that side?
You know, I think that may be reading the wrong tea leaves. I mean, if you look at the prior decisions of the court, it has been Justice Kennedy who's been the swing vote on issues concerning gay marriage. And I think it's far more likely that the more conservative justices were less than confident where Justice Kennedy's vote was going to be, and that's why they didn't take the case. I think the outcome nonetheless amounted to judicial activism. It amounted to unelected judges essentially setting aside the marriage laws in 30 states across the union. And from the beginning of our country, marriage has been a question for the states. It's been something decided at the state level. And it's one of the geniuses of our framers that we have 50 different states. As Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis put it, the states are laboratories of democracy. And I think marriage laws should reflect the values and mores of the citizens. You would expect the citizens of California to make different policy decisions than the citizens of Texas or Florida or New York. That's the way our system should be, and we shouldn't have unelected federal judges or the federal government trying to impose their policy views on state legislatures and the citizens of the 50 states.
Senator, you've got a pretty significant op-ed piece in USA Today this week talking about if Republicans take the majority, what you'd like to do. I recommend it to people. There's a lot in there we're not going to have time to get to, but I want to ask you about one thing that caught my eye. You talk about the need for congressional oversight and Senate hearings on a range of issues, one of which you say, in terms of Benghazi, that there should be careful and sober Senate hearings. What for you, just briefly, are the unanswered questions after all the hearings that have been held about the tragic Benghazi matter?
Well, unfortunately, there have been a number of hearings on the House side, and yet the administration continues to stonewall. And indeed, earlier this year, I introduced a resolution with 25 Senate co-sponsors for a joint committee to investigate Benghazi.
But, Senator, I'm sorry to interrupt, but just briefly, list the questions that you think require hearings on that matter.
Well, let me lay out what happened, because the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Menendez, came down and objected. And he said on the Senate floor, he has no idea if there was anything that the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense could have done to save those four Americans that night. He has no idea what could have been done to save them or why we didn't do it, but we needed no hearings to figure it out. Now, that was out of the mouth of Democrat Bob Menendez saying he doesn't know what we could have done to save those four Americans. We need to answer those questions. I know Secretary Clinton said, what difference does it make, you know, to the four men who lost their lives, to their families, and to servicemen and women all over the world? It makes a very real difference if we could have saved them and we left them in harm's way instead.
Senator, real quick on, I just want to ask you quickly about immigration. You are a pretty staunch opponent of comprehensive reform as it's been currently put together. There's 12 million undocumented citizens here, non-citizens here. What's your proposal to do with those 12 million? Mitt Romney was in favor of self-deportation. Where are you on that issue?
Well, look, I am a strong advocate of common sense immigration reform. And I think the way we address immigration reform, if you actually want to pass something, is you focus on areas of bipartisan agreement. There is overwhelming bipartisan agreement outside of Washington that we finally got to get serious about securing the borders and stopping the problem of illegal immigration, especially with growing threats from ISIS and Ebola, not to mention 90,000 unaccompanied children expected to come into this country. We should come together in a bipartisan way to say enough is enough. Let's secure the
Senator,
border.
Understood.
I think
what's your posture on what happens to the 12 million?
Let me answer the question. What I think we should do is focus on areas of bipartisan agreement. The first area of bipartisan agreement is securing the border and stopping the problem of illegal immigration. The second area of bipartisan agreement is improving and streamlining legal immigration so that we remain a nation that doesn't just welcome, that celebrates legal immigration. You know, I am the son of an immigrant who came legally from Cuba 57 years ago, and there is no stronger advocate of legal immigration in the Senate than I am. If you actually want to pass a bill, the way you do it is you focus on areas of bipartisan agreement. What President Obama and the Senate Democrats have done, however, is they focused on the question you're asking. They focused on the most partisan divisive elements, because I believe their objective is not to pass a bill, but rather to have what happened happen exactly as it did, to force a bad bill through the Senate that they knew would never pass the House of Representatives because they want to use it as a partisan cudgel in 2014 and 2016. When Democrats controlled both houses of Congress, they didn't pass immigration reform because they didn't want to. If you want to pass a bill, the way to do it is focus on areas of agreement, not engage in partisan warfare like President Obama and the Democrats.
All right, Senator, next time you're in New York, we're going to have you come in and talk more about those 12 million. But for now, I want to have you take off your Senator Ted Cruz face and let's go straight to some more personal and relaxed stuff. You're a big fan of the Godfather films. I'll give you two choices. One, you can do your best Godfather character imitation, or two, you can tell us who the most compelling character in the Godfather trilogy is. Up to you.
Well,
you can do both.
Much to my team's relief, I'll probably resist doing Godfather impressions. Although if you get a beer in me, I might not. But I will say, look, all three Godfathers. I mean, the most compelling character is always Michael Corleone because he's engaged in a moral battle where in each decision he's trying to do the right thing. In Godfather 1, he is trying to be the honorable one, not go into the mob, and yet his father's life is threatened and he steps up, and it's what makes it such a compelling morality tale is he tries to do the right thing and ends up being a mass murderer in every movie. And for that matter, I mean, it's summed up well in Godfather 3 when an older Michael Corleone says, "Every time I get out, they keep pulling me back in."
That may be Harry Reid's motto by the end of next week. Senator Ted Cruz from Houston, Texas. We know back here in New York we pronounce that Houston. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you again soon. Thanks, Senator. Up next, here a pig, there a pig. Everywhere a pungent Joni Ernst ad, and we'll be right back.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by BP, proud to be America's largest energy investor.
When folks think about what they get from Alaska, they think salmon and energy. But the energy BP produces up here creates something else as well. Jobs all over America. Engineering and innovation jobs, advanced safety systems and technology, shipping and manufacturing. Across the United States, BP supports more than a 250,000 jobs. When we set up operation in one part of the country, people in other parts go to work. That's not a coincidence. It's one more part of our commitment to America.
Perceptions change and evolve. In a recent Bloomberg Audience Insights report, more and more IT decision makers evaluated Android as a secure platform for large-scale business operations. In the survey, 72% of IT decision makers said they had deployed an Android device as part of a bring-your-own-device initiative. Among them, more than 9 in 10 had deployed an Android device from Samsung. One reason they trust Samsung Android devices is the Knox security platform. 79% believe Knox is extremely or very useful for application security, with 78% mirroring that sentiment for malware protection. Samsung is in the unique position to offer security that is deeply rooted in hardware and constantly moves forward to help business realize the full potential of mobility.
Only Bloomberg Television has the interviews you want to hear.
One of the fascinating things about Twitter is that once you get it, it becomes indispensable to you.
My eyes were all created equal.
Online, on your tablet, and on your phone. Bloomberg Television, wherever you are.
Last spring, Joni Ernst became famous for an ad in which she said she grew up castrating pigs.
Now she has a new ad on the same theme, a kind of swinish sequel, and Mark is going to Mary Poppins himself right into the picture. Take it away, Mark.
It's a mess. Dirty, noisy, and it stinks.
Oh, it stinks. Welcome back, Joan Ernst. It's nice to see you back in the environment that made you famous when you talked about, during the primary season, castrating hogs. See, you've moved on a little bit. The visual, though, is clear. You want to remind voters why they nominated you in the first place without saying in a big, loud voice, I'm the one who castrates pigs.
Too many typical politicians. Hogging, wasting, and full of, well, let's just say, bad ideas. It's time to stop spending money we don't have and balance the budget.
So your plan is to balance the budget. Very original idea. I'm not really sure that what you're saying politicians are full of. They're full of shit. They're full of pork. I guess either one would work, but overall, I'm not really sure what your point is.
I'm Joni Ernst.
Ah, you're Joni Ernst. Thanks for elaborating on how you'd balance the budget.
I approve this message because cleaning up the mess in Washington is going to take a whole lot of Iowa common sense.
Had to sneak one last snort in there, didn't you? Look, I know it's a 30-second ad. There's not a lot of time, but this is one of your closing arguments. It's you and a bunch of hogs, and you're saying you've got a plan to balance the budget with no details? I think maybe you need to shoot another ad. John?
Mark, I have some advice for you. I think it's time for you to clean off your shoes. And while you do, we'll be right back.
Koch Industries started in the heartland, and we've expanded to nearly every state. Today, that's more than 60,000 American jobs. You may not always see our name on the products you use, but we help make better food, clothing, shelter, technologies, and other necessities. Here, we build on each other's ideas to create more opportunities for people everywhere. Together, we are Coke.
This is the storm.
There's a storm coming.
That whipped through the turbine, which poured surplus energy into the plant, which generously lowered its price, and tipped off the house, which used all that energy to stay warm through the storm.
There's a bad storm coming.
The Internet of Everything is changing how energy works. Is your network ready?
Gunderman Group.
Gunderman Group is growing.
Getting in a groove.
Growth is gratifying.
The goal is to grow.
Gotta get greater growth.
I just talked to UPS. They've got expert advice, special discounts, new technologies, like smart pickups.
They'll only show up when you print a label, and it's automatic. We save time and money.
Time? Money?
Time and money.
Awesome.
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 I love logistics.
Your business requires on-time payroll processing, affordable health benefits, workers' compensation, managing government compliance, and employee performance management. Insperity's Workforce Optimization is a suite of HR services that takes care of all of this and more, helping your company run better, grow faster, and make more money. It's what we do. Insperity, inspiring business performance.
We are only on television a half hour a day, but we are live 24-7 on BloombergPolitics.com. Right now on the site, an incredible story about the guy who was the digital guru for that man, Ted Cruz, and now has taken up the incredibly difficult task of making Mitch McConnell seem cool on the Internet.
Phil Mattingly also on BloombergPolitics.com. Great piece about Republicans lawyering up in advance of the midterms. That's it for us for now. Taking Stock is coming up on Bloomberg TV. Sayonara.
Partnerships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success.